Okay, let's see. July 20th, 1969 was a hot day in Leningrad, and it turned out to be historic. News reports announced the United States was about to land a man on the moon's surface. Actually, there were two men, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin, the crew of Apollo 11. Or three American professors lived in the same room on the third floor in dormitory number 6, and they were the only ones who had a black and white Soviet TV. We heard about it early enough so that we could see it in real time, Professor Mickelson told me many years later, when we met in St. Petersburg for the 50th anniversary of our program. Just about all the students, Americans and Soviet, came into that room. We were jammed into it like sardines, about 45 of us, watching this thing. I was happily surprised to see how genuinely the Soviet students were congratulating us, our nation, and our astronauts for this achievement, he told me. Underneath, they probably felt some envy and disappointment that it wasn't their own who had done that. That's an excerpt from an early chapter in Jill Doherty's new book, My Russia, What I Saw Inside the Kremlin, where she describes watching the moon landing from a dorm room in Leningrad. The book is a memoir of her experiences studying Russia and working there over several decades. A few years later, she toured the Soviet Union as part of the U.S. Information Agency's exhibit created under the U.S.-Soviet Cultural Agreement. Jill worked as a CNN correspondent for 3 decades, including several years as the network's Moscow bureau chief. She witnessed and reported on a whole bunch of historical events throughout the presidencies of Mikhail Gorbachev, Boris Yeltsin, Vladimir Putin, and my guest on this episode of the podcast is Jill Doherty. Welcome back to the Naked Pravda. Welcome back to the show. I'm Kevin Rothrock, your host, and it's been several months since our last episode. If you're a returning listener, thanks for not deleting this from your podcast app on your phone. If this is your first time tuning in, then, well, it's good to have you. If you're not already a supporter of Medusa, and especially if you've never even considered it, please take a look when you have the time at our website and consider making a recurring donation to help support our newsroom. We're banned in Russia for our independent reporting on the invasion of Ukraine and the Putin regime's domestic repressions, so we are totally reliant on our international audience, on people like you, to sustain our work. One more bit of housekeeping. The Naked Pravda is trying something a little different with today's interview. We're putting the whole thing up on YouTube with video footage of the conversation. In fact, I'm even recording the video feed of what I'm saying right now, so hello. Hi, if you can see me. If the idea of looking at my face for the whole show disturbs you, then, you know, don't worry. The audio version of the podcast is resuming like usual. Anyway, that's just a PSA for folks who prefer audio visuals to plain audio. For today's episode, I spoke to Jill Doherty, a longtime journalist, a fellow podcaster, an adjunct professor at Georgetown's Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies, and the author of My Russia, What I Saw Inside the Kremlin, published earlier this month and available at bookstores everywhere. Check the description of this podcast episode for a link to the publisher's website. Now let's get on with the interview. I was surprised at how personal it was. I mean, obviously the title is My Russia, so it's personal possessive pronoun. It's very personal right up front, but you know, you're including a lot about your private life. It's really your life story. And so I was wondering, at what point in your career did you decide to write a book like this? I mean, you know, to put so much of yourself into it, when did you settle on the tone and like the parameters?
You know, that's really a good question, because I did think about writing this probably maybe 10 years ago. And because everybody's writing books, and I thought, well, eventually maybe I should. But maybe like 7 or 8 years ago, I talked with a friend in the field, and I really respect his opinion. And he said, you know, Jill, like at that point, I was thinking, I will write a Putin book. And he said, Jill, there are so many great Putin books out there, which is really true. He said, "What the world does not need another Putin book right now, at least from you. So what I would suggest, he said, is you have a unique background as just a regular American who got fixated on Russia, who, you know, grew up during the Cold War. And there were a lot of moments in the Cold War that were really important to me in my life and my career. And that's kind of what I began with. So I went over and over thinking, should it be chronological or should it be like thematic? The media, Ukraine, you know, that type of thing. And then I thought, what I should probably do is keep it chronological because it bounces around a lot for like half a century. So I began actually with the full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February 2022 because I thought that was the most dramatic moment. And it also kind of defined where I'm going in my career and my interest in Russia because I went there. CNN believed the U.S. government when it said, hey, they're going to invade. So they asked me if I would go, which of course I said yes to. And that moment of just, you know, looking at Putin and being in that bureau and seeing what it felt like with my friends, Russian friends, who were saying, oh my God, I think our country is invading. And then, of course, within a few days, has invaded another country where, let's say, my grandmother lives. You know, a lot of Russians have relatives. So that was a dramatic part. And I thought it would be a good kind of framing to begin with that invasion and my experience in Moscow, actually not in Kyiv, but in Moscow, where I'd spent so much of my life. And then bookend it at the end of the book by saying, this is what I, you know, personally think happened. This is what the war is doing, has done to Russia and Ukraine, or I should say Ukraine and Russia. And then I did put in a little section on Georgia because I went to Georgia last year, so 2024. I went to Georgia actually three times, and I find myself going there quite a lot. I'm going to go in June. And there were so many issues there that seem part of this narrative. So I put a little section at the end. But then when you talk about the personal stuff, so, you know, then I thought, ooh, how much of me do I put in it? Because I've been a journalist for a long time, and I did a lot of, you know, reporting on Russia, et cetera. But I'd never really talked about myself, and it was kind of uncomfortable. And I also thought it could be a little, I don't know, like, do I really need to say that? But the problem was, or the, you know, the issue for me was that there were aspects of my personal life, like cancer, that became part of the story. I mean, you know, I was diagnosed in Russia. So do I stay in Russia, you know, to get treated? Do I come back to the United States? It affected my reporting because it was right around the time that they were going to have the first election for Putin. So that's why I decided to put it in. So, it's very personal. I don't know. I mean, it's kind of weird because I started thinking, ooh, yikes, you know, there's no going back. But anyway, it's out there.
You mentioned at various points in the book that you were writing to yourself in a diary. Was that, did you use that as source material for writing the book, or did you remember it all by heart, or how did that play in?
Oh, brother. You know, I would never be able, no, seriously, I would never, ever be able to remember everything. But there were moments like, so going back to my high school, my teacher in high school changed my life because he was such a dedicated teacher of the Russian language. He
this
grew
is the
up
guy
with,
who banged on the table and
yeah,
refused to speak English.
Ship
yeah.
up or ship out. And then, but he didn't speak English for months. Right. So we were convinced he only spoke Russian. But he was extremely dedicated. And I truly owe my career to him. There's no question. So about, I think, again, getting back to that, like 6 or 7 years ago, I thought I should talk with him. I should interview him just so I understand, you know, like what I remember, did that really happen? And then also, what was his life like? So that was in Scranton, Pennsylvania. And I went back to Scranton and I said, Mr. Peregrine, could I talk with you? So I went to his kitchen. His wife was there, Pat, and we talked. And I recorded that interview. And a year later, he died. So all of that would have been lost if I hadn't followed my instinct just to talk to him. And then the other, there were two other things. The literally verbatim stuff from being a guide on U.S. Information Agency exhibits back in the old Soviet days, and my time at Leningrad State University. All of that came about. It was amazing to me. I have a friend who's from Ireland. He's an Irish scholar, actually, in the Irish language. And I gave myself a birthday present a few years ago, and I went to Ireland. And at the end of the trip, he said, his name is Doro O'Boyle. And he said, Jill, I have a little gift for you. You know, and I said, oh, I don't need anything. What are you talking about? And he gave me a package. And I opened that package, and inside were all, probably all, of the letters, literally letters that Pam, my twin sister, and I, who studied Russian together, had written back to my parents and to Donald over the years. And they were like, they were really detailed. Yeah. I mean, this is the days of like onion skin paper and then that really harsh Soviet paper and, you know, the stamps and everything with, you know, workers of the world unite and all of that. So he kept those, if you can imagine that, for like 50 years. And then he gave them to me. So what I did was I actually sat down and transcribed them, you know, literally, because it really was important. And then the final thing was reporting from CNN. And I tried keeping a diary, but it was really, really hard because the schedule was just insane. So luckily, CNN, even after I left full time, would send me back for like a month or two when usually bad things happened to report on. Yeah. And this one time I said, hey, you know, I should start looking at my old scripts. And I said, are they still in that, the lodge? Like there was a, I guess you'd call it an online way that we logged scripts. And they said, oh, well, that's going to die because it's so antiquated, we're going to go to a completely new system. And I said, well, what happens to the old scripts? And they said, oh, they go poof. You know, oh, like, man. They just get killed. And I said, uh-huh. Oh, my God, you've got to be kidding. So every night I would stay in the bureau at like 1 o'clock in the morning and I would print on paper, print out all those scripts. So I came back one time with literally a stack of my scripts for almost a decade. It was like 9.5 years of scripts. And it was invaluable because it had the date, the time, what city I was in, quotes verbatim. And so it was really a gold mine. So that's kind of, yeah, I can't remember, you know, things very well because it's just in the spray of events, you know, but that really helped.
I see. Okay. Another question I had, you've been talking a bit about, or you mentioned, you know, studying in high school and your childhood, and in the book, you after you have the introduction about being in Moscow for the invasion of Ukraine, you talk about being a child of the Cold War and how your father's job influenced you and kind of set you on this sort of, or it made you sort of aware, I guess, of national security or geopolitics, and that all of it kind of directed you toward Russia. And I was wondering, you know, you have students now who are, you know, young people, and you're teaching them in the, you know, contemporary context, seeing them, imagining yourself as a young person, do you think you would still gravitate toward Russia, or do you think that current trends will lead people in your situation to China or something? I know you worked in Hong Kong too, so you have, mm-hmm. you're familiar with this place too. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering, as I was reading this, I was thinking, like, I wonder if Jill Dougherty still exists today, or are they all studying China?
Well, there are certainly my students at Georgetown. Some of them are studying Russian, and they're very interested in it. I think probably, you know, I mean, at the time that I studied, it was the Cold War, and the critical language at the time was Russian. But, you know, now it probably is Chinese. Could be Russian to a certain extent, Arabic, but definitely Chinese. And it is very possible that if I had grown up at another time, like now, I might very well have been in Chinese studies. But for some reason, you know, when I started studying Russian, it just really clicked. I honestly don't know why. In fact, I think I have it in the book that I talked to my twin years later, like actually not too long ago. And I said, you know, so I presume you loved Russian too. And she said, oh no, I think it's an ugly language. You know, she likes
German. Is that how your sister speaks?
Yeah. It was like, wait a minute. You know, we both studied Russian together and like, here I am going, oh yes, more, I love her. You know? And she she actually didn't particularly like it, but I did.
But she's a polyglot now, right?
Oh my God, yes. Right. I think it's like six languages.
In terms of sourcing, not for this book, but for sort of Russia expertise as it exists in the West, I was wondering how do you think Western journalists and Western experts who work on Russia, like presumably most of them or many of them are getting less direct exposure to Russians than, you know, 10, 20 years ago. And I wonder, have you ever thought about how this might affect sort of our grasp on things? Because reading your book, I'm thinking like, wow, this is like a generation of. I mean, I know that your experiences were somewhat rare, obviously. Like, it wasn't common to go to the Soviet Union in the 70s and so on. But you know, you're living there in the 90s and the aughts and so on. And this is like an opportunity for a lot of Americans. If you're really devoted to Russia and you're not doing something like this at some point in your career, over the last 30 years at least. It was considered like, well, you're not that serious, right? You have to go and be there. And now that opportunity technically still exists, but it's not safe. I'm sure most institutions are not involved in that anymore because there's too much liability and so on. Do you see this affecting like with the kind of knowledge we're going to have? Because obviously, like, there are still Russians you can talk to, but the ones who will talk, it's very self-selected, right? Like, it's, you know, the standard kind of like liberal intelligentsia. Expats are very, you know, widely quoted in the media today, but, you know, they don't represent most Russians, but they're not even in contact with them anymore, you know, not directly. So this is a long-winded way of asking, like, where do you see the direction of things going based on the sort of the limited access?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think about it all the time because the students that I have at Georgetown, for example, who are studying Russian or want to get into maybe, you know, Russian studies or security studies, things like that. It struck me just recently, really viscerally, that they may not get a chance to go to Russia for quite a while. And it just sickened me to think about that. Because, you know, my key to understanding Russia was 1969, living in a dormitory in Leningrad with no hot water and going to the banya and going to stores and just schlepping around and seeing what life was like and sitting in the kitchen with my friends who were Russians who had everything in one room. You know, they could, as we say so many times, you know, the conversations around the kitchen table were the only way that they could really express themselves and have friends that they trusted. All of that, you cannot learn that in a textbook. And so when I look at Putin, it's not just like, you know, does he have an ideology or, you know, what is he trying to do? And, you know, what was that treatise that he wrote about Ukraine? I think of Leningrad. I think of Putin and his parents during World War II, his mother almost dying of starvation, which I actually do believe. I mean, we have to go on something. And I do believe she actually almost died of starvation because so many people in Leningrad did die of starvation. And just walking down the streets in 1969 taught me more about reality than a lot of stuff I ever learned in class. And to this day, I'm serious, I think about it all the time, like, what's really going on here, you know? And it's just crucial. So that is, you know, students, but it's also journalists. I honestly don't know how you could cover the place if you didn't go there. And I know some people, you know, now the Russian government is cutting back on visas so that when you go in, we used to get three-year visas, multiple entry, and now they're cutting it down. I think the latest I heard was 3 months, and it's one entry, and then you have to apply again. So, yeah, journalists go in, and they do live shots, and they report as well as they can. But that's not like, you know, walking down the streets or talking with people, sitting in a cafe, going to a theater, or going to stores and seeing how prices are, you know, that's really important. The Soviet Union that I encountered when I went there for the first time,
First time was in 69.
69. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So obviously no computers, and you could not get Western newspapers. There was Voice of America, RFERL, that type of, you know, foreign broadcasting, BBC, etc.
You but got a that lot by, of, by radio.
Yeah, shortwave radio. But a lot of that was jammed. You know, they would create a signal to block it. So the odd thing about that was, even though the propaganda was really, you know, America is a capitalist country and the government takes advantage of the workers who are, you know, left with no protections and they're not well paid and all of this, there was kind of an underlying, I'd say, openness. And I'm judging, this again is my personal experience, but on that exhibit that went, you know, for a half year, we went to three different cities and then would travel in between, but literally in a city answering questions for like 8 hours a day. So
sounds
I found
exhausting.
It was exhausting, but it was fascinating because, you know, you could see that their questions were really interesting. Yeah. And I learned a lot. But I think there was like an underlying belief, and I'm going to describe it this way. They didn't really believe what they were told by Soviet propaganda. A lot of people, they're not stupid. They were not stupid then, and they're not stupid now. So they knew, hey, they're lying to us. But they weren't exactly sure how. So the questions would be like, where do you live? And then I'd say, I live in a house, and my parents have six kids. And, you know, and they were actually, they didn't know necessarily that my parents had six kids, but they might have had an idea that we lived in a house, but they couldn't quite fathom that. So when I said, yes, you know, I live in a house, they would say, well, shouldn't you just live in an apartment? You know, because Soviet life. But there was almost, I shudder to kind of go this far, maybe it's not smart, but it was kind of like more positive viewpoint of Americans. Like they hated the government, you know, did not like capitalists for the most part, but they kind of felt that Americans as people were okay. And I think that communism, that system, actually there was a lot, perhaps you can understand some of this yourself because of your background in Russia and Russian. There was that expression, mir i druzhba, you know, peace and friendship. And we used to laugh about it, but I mean, the Soviets actually didn't say, let's go bomb Paris, you know, which is, well, you know, a certain leader who shall remain nameless right now, but Mr. Medvedev, I will put it on the record, says, you know, hey, let's bomb Paris, let's bomb London. You know, they didn't do that. It was more, these people are bad for workers. So I would say it was actually more positive. So now, I think, you know, what Russians know, Russians, up until Putin, recent Putin, they could almost travel anywhere they wanted if they had the money. They could go around Europe. Maybe they could get to the United States. They certainly had access to media until Putin began to shut down the media. But there was, I'm going to say, like, no excuse for not knowing a lot about the United States and about the West. And there was sincere interest in that, you know. Now, it's very different because it's draconian control of the media, as we both know. But I think there's an edge to it, which is different. Or let's say that there's a different approach. And the way I'd put it, just saw a study about this, which I think confirms it. Young people in Russia right now, literally according to some studies that exist, are cynical about the West. Like, they may know, or they probably definitely know, that people as a whole live better in the West, maybe not better than in Moscow because it's so rich, but, you know, people, an average person lives much better in the West than they do in Russia. There's no question. So you would think, oh, it's kind of like the old days. They will say, well, we kind of like the system. No, it's more that they've been told the West, yeah, sure, the West is better, but it's all corrupt anyway, because they just talk about democracy. This is all in quotes. They, you know, the West just talks about democracy. And they say, you know, life is much better here, et cetera. There's a cynicism that Putin is using. So that is what he does. He undermines young Russians' belief that the West is a good place. You know, Putin would say, it's all the same. They're lying. They ultimately want to take over Russia. They ultimately want to destroy our country. If they say they welcome you, it's a lie. That type of stuff is very, very cynical. And I didn't feel that in the Soviet Union. It was completely different.
What was it like watching the moon landing from Leningrad?
Oh, wow. I mean, yeah, there were, you know, here we are in a dorm, and it's like the first man lands on moon, and there was kind of like a scratchy, you know, Soviet TV and black and white. But it was a moment that I thought, well, number one, I was blown away that there was actually, you know, a guy on the moon,
yeah.
A United States person. Mm-hmm. But also, there were people who joined us, as you read. There were Russians, like Russian students, who came into the room. There was one room where they had a TV. And we watched it together. And there was actually this feeling that, hey, that's a human being out there. You know, it's not just an American. It was kind of like, hats off to the Americans. They did a good job. But wow, that's human beings out there. And there was this kind of feeling that humanity had done it, which I found very refreshing and actually very touching, deeply touching.
Another question I had from the book, there's a section where you compare your father to Putin, essentially, or wondering if like the two shared certain, you know, career traits or personality traits. And I wondered what inspired you to think about that. Like, did you, was the first time you saw Putin, did you think, hey, that reminds me of my dad? Or was it something you came to later?
Well, I mean, we should say my father was a career FBI agent.
Right.
Special agent of the FBI.
Yes.
So, the you know, right from the beginning, as I guess I mentioned in the book, I kind of, part of my fascination was big, bad Soviet Union, know the enemy, you know, that type of thing. And I'd read every Nancy Drew book available. So I was kind of like an intrepid little girl. And I started thinking, you know, this would be very cool to study Russian, and maybe it will help my country, that type of thing.
Sure. Yeah.
But I think, it sounds kind of strange to say, was my father like Putin? No, my father was not like Putin. However, they came from organizations, the FBI and the KGB, that had kind of, you know, to a certain extent, similar functions, you know. And then I started thinking, I have enormous respect for my father. And I started thinking, could there be anything that they had in common? And I think maybe, and this is really perhaps going too far, but I think Putin did or does maybe still have this idea that he was going to protect Russia. Now, his idea of protection may be really faulty. You know, the best protection is to attack. You know, that seems to be his approach. But I think there was a certain superficial similarity. But I think, number one, their personalities were completely different. You know, I find Putin, as I say, pretty much a Soviet man. I don't think he's ever been able to get out of that mentality. You know, other people did. Other people lived in the Soviet Union too, and they turned out to be pretty normal. I think Putin retained much of that idea, chip on the shoulder, West out to get us type of stuff. And to his detriment and to his country's detriment, I think, you know, one of the saddest things, Kevin, that I think about is what he is doing to Russia and what he's doing to Russian young people and the future, the country that they're going to live in. But yeah, I kind of went through both of those. But also, I think there's one other thing about the two men. You know, the United States and Russia, my father growing up, or actually he was already grown by this time, but the end of World War II, America is a country that survives and thrives and, you know, is the world leader. Soviet Union physically destroyed. Leningrad, you know, houses just bombed to smithereens. A difficult life, whereas the United States was booming. That 1950s life that my parents had was so different from Putin. And that affected things too, you know, that it was rich and successful for many people, not for, you know, some minorities. Obviously in the United States did not do well, but the country as a whole pretty much boomed after World War II. And it created very different people. Again, Putin with this, I still have, the best way I can describe it is chip on the shoulder approach to the world.
Do you think that going forward, the kind of engagement that Americans will need to embrace, not necessarily approve of, but just it'll have to be what they do in terms of the Russians they speak to. A lot of your book, you know, when you're in the Soviet Union, you're engaging sort of anybody you can come into contact with. And then after the fall of the Soviet Union, America kind of inherits this mission of like, okay, well, we want to, you know, steward Russia onto a path that integrates it into the world order that, you know, that we dominate. But it's democratic, too. There's like normative and there's more expedient reasons to do these things. And now it seems as though there's been this retrenchment, and the Russians who were on board with the, you know, liberal world order have for the most part left, or they've just fallen silent. And so the Russians who have decision-making power, certainly, but even perhaps just the sort of general majority, their baseline are they say things and they believe things that are kind of verboten in American discourse. And so do you think that if you're an expert or you're a journalist, this is for a narrow audience, this question, but if you're an expert or a journalist, you just have to come to terms with the idea that if you're going to engage Russians and talk to Russians, you have to kind of set aside like the moral revulsion and just kind of engage them with that somehow forgotten? Or like, how does that factor into the work that people have to do?
Well, you know, some Russians have that moral revulsion too. So, I mean, I think, you know, it almost always boils down to, can Russians do democracy? You know, like when you're dealing with them, is it just a lost cause? Like, will we always have this enemy, and will they always have a leader who pulls them back, you know, et cetera? I think what I try to do is think, and this, I actually talked with my students about this just recently, that in the darkest moments, you can have leaders like Gorbachev. Now, many Russians hate him, excoriate his name, because they think he brought down the Soviet Union.
Right.
But I mean, there was a guy who came out of the system and actually talked about things like glasnost, and people were able to read books that they'd never been able to read before, and society really did change. Now, in the process, he did bring down the Soviet Union, and that's, you know, just what happened. But I think unexpected things can happen. So I try, it's almost like two parts of my brain. You know, part of it is like, oh, wow, why does it continue to go back to this ruler? Like, you know, Putin is bringing them back to the Soviet Union type of thing. But then the hope that things really can change. And I do think, even though this is a pretty cynical young generation in Russia right now, that there are people who just want a better Russia, a Russia that they can love and respect, which they always will. I think Russians as a group are quite patriotic, but that it's a country that they can, I don't know, that it becomes a normal country where you're not shaken down by the police and you can express your views, and it's not, and society is not top down, that there are there's civil society that can be bottom up. And I know that exists. Every time it seems to kind of rise to the surface, kind of like little shoots of grass, they get lopped off, you know, by the grass cutters in the Kremlin. But I do think that I keep that hope. And I don't think it's, you know, Pollyannish. I really do think that things, unexpected things can happen. And sometimes they can be positive.
Last question I had has to do with the environment or the how fertile the grounds are in the United States currently for fostering future generations of Russia experts and journalists who will focus on Russia. Obviously, it's very difficult, if not impossible, for most people to actually go there and do, you know, the work of the field. Certainly, you can't go there and, or you can, if you go there and do a lot of, if you do your job in a lot of different fields, you're breaking the law because there's so many restrictions on speech and criticism of government policy and so on. But that has to do, we've talked about, you know, the repressive laws in Russia. In the United States, there's been a lot of, I mean, there's been a change in administrations, obviously, which has led to shutdowns of things that are integral in your story. Voice of America, for instance, hasn't updated their, or they haven't broadcast or updated their website in more than a month as we're recording right now. I went and looked at their website just because I was, I know what happened, but I was like, I need to see the website. I want to actually, is it really frozen? Like, is there no new news? And there, sure enough, like there's nothing since, you know, mid-March. And RFERL is sort of, you know, limping along, unclear how they're still putting out content, but they are. And I don't know how much, but I don't know for how much longer. You know, the Wilson Center is no more, and or almost no more. And it just seems like there's going to be far less sort of lifts, professional social lifts for Americans who want to follow this path. This is something I kept thinking about reading your book, especially the first half where you're talking about how you really get into it and how you use the various opportunities that are present for Americans. When you look at the changes and witness sort of both like the longer term stuff when it comes to shifts in, you know, journalism as an industry, but also more the more recent and hopefully temporary changes in U.S. government policy, what do you think about the sort of near and long term future for this field?
You know, Kevin, I was at a conference just, I guess it's last week, about Russia. And there were some really, really good researchers. And we were, you know, the discussion was, how do you get information about Russia? How do you understand what's going on? So a lot of them at this point are using data. They do data analysis. They do all sorts of, you know, technical, using AI, very sophisticated analysis of data from Russia. Could be health data. It could be a lot of stuff. And they find out very interesting things about how Russia is functioning. I'll just, you know, quick example, like how many people are going to the psychiatrist? You know, well, it goes up when you have an invasion or a war, and then it goes down when people feel peaceful. So they gather a lot of this. And I thought, yeah, that's really great. It's quite interesting. The only thing is the human element. And I keep going back to that, you know, you really can't understand what it's like for people in that country, I think, unless you get there. And you don't have to spend years, but you have to get there. You have to walk the streets. You have to talk with people. You have to eat the food. You have to listen to the music. And I think that, you know, that is how you understand. And without that, if there's an absence of doing that, if it's impossible to get to Russia, then I do not think we're going to understand Russia correctly. We'll have data, you know, we'll have data, we'll have information, we can analyze what Putin says, and all that is really, really valuable. But what's it like for Russians right now? Why do they support Putin? The best way to find out is to talk with people. And Putin doesn't want you to do that. So he's not allowing, you know, or they're arresting, you know, Americans and holding them. But that's what has to happen. So I'm hoping that eventually we can get through this period where it's really valuable to arrest an American and use them to exchange for a KGB agent or FSB. So that's it. I'm not very positive about that. It's a real problem.
And what do you tell your students in terms of, you know, they come and study it, and anybody, maybe they're doing just as a part of their general education, or they want to have like some specialization, but it's part of something else. But if they were to come and say, if they share, you know, the passion that you describe in your book for Russia specifically, and they say they really want their their career to revolve around it. What's your advice to them, seeing, you know, those sort of opportunities kind of evaporate, at least in the United States?
Well, you know, the next best thing is to go to the neighborhood. So a number of them, like some of my students, just went to Armenia. You know, there's Georgia, there's, let's say, the Baltic countries. You know, you can go to places that were part of the former Soviet Union, where you could at least get, you know, a little bit of the flavor. And there happened to be a lot of Russian speakers in all of those areas. So, in fact, some have just recently left. And so there are ways that you can talk with former, you know, Russian civilians and journalists. There are all sorts who are out. And just, you know, the next best thing. And then also, I think, culture. You know, YouTube still exists, although the government, the last time I saw, the Kremlin was trying to slow it down so people, you know, can't see videos that well. But YouTube is there. Culture, music, things like that. You can still get on those sites, and you can still see what Russians are listening to and thinking about. So there are other ways. We just have to do it.
Is there a danger in if American and Western experts generally, if they're kind of left in terms of like the remaining direct interactions available, are all either the like dissidents who have left or the diasporas who generally have, I mean, it seems like they're on both sides of the spectrum and in different places, but I would hesitate to say that you could meet a diaspora Russian and that they are, their like politics would coincide exactly with like the mainland or whatever, right? Because usually they seem, in my anecdotal experience, like they're either radicalized one way or the other. They're either like rabidly anti-Putin, yeah, or they're like, you know, our rights are trampled in here in the Baltics. Like, you know, we need to stand up for ourselves. It goes one way or the other.
Yeah.
So hearing that, I'm thinking like, oh gosh, like American and Russia expertise is going to be like, all the only source material we're going to have are like these disaffected dissidents or these disaffected diaspora people. Meanwhile, like, you know, Ivan Ivanovich is just like going to the office and like living on like Mars for all we know. Like, it's a totally different world.
Well, you know what I tell my students? There's a course that I teach at Georgetown that I call The Putin Generation.
And you talk about you're worried about the title and so on. And
because I mean, I thought maybe that's a little toxic, but no, I'm going to keep it as the Putin generation. Although I don't think they are necessarily the Putin generation.
I mean, it's a good title. It's good grabs.
I mean, it historically captures them. These are young people who have grown up with no leader other than Vladimir Putin.
Right.
So, they're the Putin generation. But what I encourage my students to do, we do a lot of culture. I go back. Like Victor Tsoi. Do you know Victor Tsoi, the musician?
Kino, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Kino. Okay. Well, I mean, there's a guy, he's dead now. He died at, I think, age 27 or 28, tragically, but incredible star in the Soviet Union. And he expressed the angst of a generation, right? So I have my students listen to his music, watch him perform. It's all over YouTube. You can find they love it. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I listened to him just for the fun of it. But, I mean, he was an incredible artist, really. Mm-hmm. So I get them to look at him back in the old Soviet days. And then we look at him, how he has been co-opted by Putin today. His music is used for like pro-Putin rallies because it's so darn strong and effective. So I think there are ways that you can kind of give people an idea of what makes people tick. Like, why would that music and those lyrics be influential, you know, 40 years ago, whatever, and today? Because he was saying something. So that's what I try to give. You know, the next best thing to, I guess, what I experienced, I tell them about the dorm. I tell them about, you know, no hot water. I tell them about the banya. Mm-hmm. And but just to give, like, the humanity of it. I'll say one last thing, which is, you know, we have this idea, big bad Soviet Union. It's not really a country. It's more a concept. You know, Russia, yikes. And it's a country. It is a country, and it has people, and people who run around thinking, you know, not about politics all the time, but how do I get a good job and where do my kids go to school and, you know, how can they get a good education and what's happening, that type of thing. And I think we have to remember that it is people, you know, it's a country with people that is very important for us to understand, because even if it gets poor, even if it is, you know, militarily weaker at this point, it will always, at least I think, for the foreseeable future, be influential. And we have to understand them. And the only way we can understand it is by looking at the country, but also at the people.
Thanks again for tuning in, folks. Remember to visit Meduza's website to read our reporting. And again, please consider making a recurring donation to help sustain our newsroom's work. Until next time.